Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives.
Have you ever felt betrayed? Have you ever felt as though life was just never going to be the same and you were going to be angry forever? Well, if you have, you join many people, but today's guest is here to tell us that there is life and there is love after betrayal. I'm very pleased to introduce you to Dr. Stephen Stosny, who is author of Living and Loving After Betrayal, How to Heal from Emotional Abuse, Deceit, Infidelity, and Chronic Resentment. Dr. Stosny, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you again.
Now, Dr. Stosny, you are the founder of Compassion Power. Tell us what Compassion Power is.
Well, it's a very small agency, but it stands on the principle that we are more powerful when we're compassionate than when we're angry. Because although we identify anger with power, it's really almost impossible to act in your long-term best interest when you're angry. It's much easier to act in your best interest when you're compassionate. And that's really what power is. It's not shooting yourself in the foot. It's acting in your best interest.
Now, compassion power is described as an I see from your book is an anger regulation program, but many of us don't think about anger regulation, and we've all heard about anger management programs. Is there a difference?
Yeah, there is. With anger management, oh, and by the way, Compassion Power is a lot more than anger regulation. I just wanted to throw that out there. But the difference between regulation and management is with anger management, you're trying to reduce the symptoms so that you don't act on impulsively or make things worse. See, anger is a perception something bad's happening or might happen, and anger tends to make it worse. On the other hand, anger regulation actually changes the experience from anger to another emotion, usually interest, but somebody you love, compassion, or caring. Just like a thermostat regulates discomfort in the room by dropping or raising the temperature, that's how anger regulation works. The problem with anger management is that you learn various techniques in a calm learning environment, in a classroom or a therapist's office, but then you won't have access to those when you're in an aroused environment. What I always say is, how will Mr. Hyde remember what Dr. Jekyll learned in anger management class? With anger regulation, you're actually building a new habit. You're associating, we call it core value, state of improving, appreciating, connecting, or protecting with whatever stimulated the anger. And you just practice that. It takes about 6 weeks of practice. And then you start automatically regulating anger.
So, in fact, it makes it, I would think, less scary to think about. Anger management kind of sounds like this thing that you have to constantly sort of quash down, whereas anger regulation sounds like something a lot more human.
Yeah, I never liked the term anger management. I know even when I was way back in the 20th century when I was in graduate school. For that reason, you know, your emotions aren't something to be managed because they are, they evolve to serve your best interest. The problem is, in a very complex world, anger is a blunt instrument, and the complex world needs a fine instrument. So it usually is too much or too late with an anger response. But it shouldn't be managed. It should be. See, the response of anger in all humans and adults requires a perception of vulnerability plus threat. Now, the more vulnerable you feel, the more threat you're going to perceive. Just managing those symptoms can actually make you feel more vulnerable and more threatened. What we try to do is remove the vulnerability, raise self-value when you feel devalued, and then you don't need anger as a defense. We really make it unnecessary.
Well, you've just introduced the word devalued, and you heard me say at the very beginning, use the term betrayal. And certainly for many people, the experience of betrayal leaves them feeling devalued. And then it almost becomes sort of a tumbling down the mountain of many, many negative emotions. When talk about that, if you would respond to that. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yes, absolutely. But let me normalize it a little bit. Feeling of betrayal is very natural. It's been with us forever, and will be with us forever. But the problem is that you feel devalued by it, and when you feel devalued, you have to do something that's going to raise your self-value. Anger is not about value. Anger makes you feel temporarily more powerful, and that's because it has adrenaline and cortisol in it, and they work like an amphetamine. You get a surge of energy and confidence, but then when it wears off, you feel depressed. Like any other amphetamine, you crash. Raising your self-value is what we need to learn to do, and you do that by more humane kinds of behaviors, compassion, kindness, caring, support. It's hard to start doing that with the person who betrayed you, but you start doing it with other people, your children, your friends, even strangers on the street. The more you do that, the more valuable you feel, and the less you need anger. Anger is about revenge, and revenge rarely makes it better.
Well, in the case of infidelity, for example, the initial response, well, there are lots of initial responses, if you will, but, you know, after you're, or while you're still dealing with perhaps the shock and the dismay and the anger, there's nothing more that you really want other than to get revenge. You really want that person to pay for whatever you believe he or she has done to you.
What we ask people to do, and the recovery from betrayal is long. It's not something you're going to do very quickly because there's a grieving process has to go in it. Your relationship is not what you thought it was. So you have to grieve what you thought it was and come to a new reality where over time you can establish an intimate connection again. But we ask people to, the revenge motive is natural, but if you act out the revenge, do you really want your partner to suffer like you have suffered? Will that make you feel more lovable, more valuable? Will that put you more in touch with your basic humanity? And it really doesn't. See, the urge for revenge is much stronger than the satisfaction that comes from revenge. The satisfaction that comes from revenge lasts about 10 minutes. You know, the most tragic example of that is the person who murders a betraying partner and then commits suicide once they realize the horror of what they've done. So the urge for revenge is much stronger than any satisfaction you'll ever get out of it.
So when you put it in those terms, it's like 10 minutes of joy for not much else. It's really good for you. It really does help perhaps the listener to take the concept of revenge and put it in a different perspective.
Yeah, what we need to do is replace the urge for revenge with the desire to heal. You've been hurt, and when you're hurt, you need to heal. In fact, revenge, fantasies of revenge prevent healing because to justify the hostility, you have to have an open wound. So revenge keeps the wound open. And you're not going to be better, it seems, until somebody else suffers. But then when they are suffering, you're not going to feel more humane. You're not going to feel better.
And then I think another piece to that is very often, I've heard people say, well, but he's not suffering enough, or, you know, she's really not broken up enough. And so it almost sounds like it becomes a never-ending, unfulfilled fantasy.
Well, there's two components to that. One is pure revenge. I want him to suffer. Another, though, is if I really know that you feel bad about hurting me, then I can begin to trust that you won't do it again because you don't want to feel that bad. And that part of it is a lot more understandable and a lot more conducive to healing. I do want assurances that you're not going to do it again, and feeling bad about it is one way. So what the betraying partner in a relationship has to do is know how much they appreciate and care that this has caused pain for their partners. My experience since 30 years of dealing with all kinds of deceit and infidelity is that first of all, infidelity only breaks up 14% of relationships. And then it's almost always when the woman has an affair, men have a harder time taking it.
What's your thought about that? I mean, that's a really interesting statistic, that it only breaks up 14% of the time. What's your thought about the gender differences in terms of reactions?
Well, the gender differences goes back to the paternity issue. Men never really know if they're the father of a child, or women pretty much always know that you're the mother. So it's always that doubt. And then there's patriarchy involved in it, too. You know, somebody else is plowing my field, to use the old term. But it's more of an insult to the pride for a man, where it's more an injury to the heart, I think, for a woman. And most women are emotionally resilient. You know, that talk about the weaker sex is nonsense. Women endure more pain and overcome at a much faster rate than men do. One example of that is chronic pain disorders. That's pain that has no physical marker to it. 90% of those are women, and that's because estrogen makes you a little more sensitive to anxiety, and it's a fear-based problem. The pain travels on fear circuits. So 90% of them are women. But if a man does develop it, he's at high risk of suicide, where if a woman has chronic pain disorder, she almost never will even consider suicide. So if men can't take the pain, women take it much better. So women are more resilient. They can overcome those wounds of the heart. And eventually they will, even with revenge motives, but the revenge motives drag it out so long, it'll take years to overcome it if you're entertaining fantasies of revenge or if you really want that person to suffer.
Well, it's also interesting that you give the statistic of only 14% of relationships in which there is infidelity actually end. Is that what you're saying?
Well, where the infidelity is the cause of the ending.
I
sometimes,
see. Okay.
Sometimes there's abuse and infidelity, so it's a combination of factors. But where there's just infidelity, most relationships are able to overcome it.
And would you say where there is abuse, that many times infidelity is also a part of that?
It often is, because see, an abuser doesn't feel very good about himself or herself. Because when you hurt somebody you love, it's really not possible to like yourself. You can have a kind of narcissistic grandiosity, but at heart, you're feeling guilty and ashamed. And that's the person that's most likely to have an affair, a person who feels bad about himself or herself, because then you've got this new person who doesn't know you very well, doesn't know all of your flaws, and I think the excitement about it is that you can be someone else, someone purer with the affair partner. So it's the guilt and shame. An abuser is like more likely to be unfaithful sexually because of the guilt and shame that's coming from the abuse.
Okay. Talk about deceit. How are you defining deceit as distinguished from infidelity?
Well, these days we're seeing a lot of deceit about finances. You know, one partner will do something with the 401k that the other partner doesn't know about. That when you hear people talking about that kind of financial betrayal, it sounds, you would swear they're talking about sexual betrayal. It sounds just the same, because your floor security is swept out from under you without your knowledge and without you doing anything wrong. So deceit is hard to take because we rely on people we love to be truthful with us. We want to be able to trust that what they're doing and saying is the truth.
So it is indeed possible to experience deceit in a relationship and it not necessarily be linked to infidelity. It could be linked to finances. Could it be linked to other things as well?
Yeah, it can be linked to dealings with in-laws. It can be linked to friends. You know, I have one man who remained friends with another man who assaulted his wife, but he didn't, because he knew that man from the time they were kids, and he didn't want to break off the relationship, but of course his wife wanted him to. And he lied about that to her for a couple of years. The thing about deceit is it almost always eventually is discovered, and the longer it goes on, the worse it is. You're much better off to have it come out sooner rather than later.
In the instance that you just described, with the man who was choosing to remain friends with someone who had harmed the wife, might she feel, in addition to deceived by the fact that he kept it a secret, might there be a sense of betrayal on her part?
Well, he wasn't protecting her, yeah. We want people we love to stand up for us. So what attachment has to provide is somebody who's going to be there for you when you need them, and an instinct to protect goes with the attachment bond. In fact, that's the natural purpose of anger in social animals. It's the self-protection is a secondary function of anger. Like, when will you get the angriest? If I attack you or your children?
It's an interesting point. Yeah,
it's primarily to protect attachment figures. It's actually meant to override self-protection. You'll risk your life if you see your children being attacked. But when you're being attacked, your brain's trying to say, how can I get out of this with minimal losses? You don't think that with when you're somebody you love is being attacked. So yeah, it's failure of protection. I think that's secondary to the deceit, because if you know, what we arrived at in the therapy with this couple is if this man had told her that, you know, I've known this guy since childhood, he had a bad time with you, I respect that of you, but I have to keep some kind of contact with him. In other words, he'd been honest with her, but he didn't want to get her upset, so he said, I'm not going to see him anymore, not going to have anything to do with him anymore. He didn't negotiate about it. He just lied about it.
Which, and of course, actually upset her more when she found out about it.
Absolutely, because that's a betrayal on top of the initial failure to protect.
These kinds of situations that we're talking about, there is healing after them, which is so much of what living and loving after betrayal is about. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, we will continue with looking at not only things that can impact one's satisfying sense of self and safety, but also ways to heal. We'll be back in just a moment. Dr. Stosny, we've been talking a lot about infidelity and some about deceit. Talk more about emotional abuse for a moment, if you would. What does that look like in a relationship?
Well, the way I like to define emotional abuse is it's hurting, deliberately hurting someone's feelings, making them feel bad about themselves, so they will do what you want. So that's the function of it, and that can take many, many forms. It can be criticism. It can be... And another important thing about emotional abuse in intimate relationships is behaviors that would not be abusive in other kind of relationships can be in an intimate relationship, because an abuse is really about the abuse of power. You're misusing power that you have. And in a love relationship, you have enormous power over the well-being of the person you're attached to, whether you want it or not. It goes with love. And misusing that power is really what abuse is.
So give me an example.
I'm sorry.
Give me an example of a behavior that might not seem abusive outside of an intimate relationship, but would within the intimate relationship.
Well, in an intimate relationship, you have you make an implicit promise and a formation of a bond that I will care how you feel, and I'll never intentionally hurt you. And that promise is always made when you form a bond. Imagine somebody you fell in love with, and if you had to call that person with bad news while you were falling in love with them, God forbid, you know, my mother died last night. If that person had responded, well, tough, get over it, I just want a few laughs here, would you have fallen in love with him?
Probably not.
No, you wouldn't. We only form bonds with someone who seems, at least, to care about how we feel, especially when we feel bad. And that's why you can take your boss on his iPad while you're talking to him or her. But it's another matter when your loved one does it, because your boss never promised to care about how you feel, and your loved one did.
Gotcha.
And that's really the nature of betrayal. In a close relationship, just failure of compassion, you know, I don't care how you feel, feels like abuse, where it wouldn't be in other social contexts.
I see.
And we have to be sensitive to that, because each time we fail to care about how our partners feel, we're creating resentment. Can you think of anything you resent more than your partner not caring how you feel?
It's kind of difficult.
That's mostly what we fight about. We don't fight about money, sex, jealousy, raising the kids and in-laws, and division of labor. That's what people tell researchers they fight about. Those things trigger disconnection, and what you fight about is the belief that your partner doesn't care how you feel about this. Not that they agree with what you think about it, but that they don't care how you feel about it. And that's what we really fight about. If you feel your feelings are valued, you tend to give and take in a negotiation. But if you don't feel that your feelings are valued, that's when you get angry and want to fight.
You say that there is an effect, and a negative effect, of being resentful all the time. What are some...
When you're resentful, you don't really like yourself. It's very difficult to like yourself. Not that you don't deserve to. You do deserve to like yourself, but it's hard to do. And the reason is you're in a constant devalued state. And the devalued state is what justifies the adrenaline from the resentment. So you're like a junkie to get that drug, you got to put yourself in a bad state. You got to go through withdrawal, and then that justifies getting the drug. That's really how resentment works. It keeps you in a devalued state. And that's what we try to get people to see. It's not whether it's justified. It probably is justified. But the right question is, do you want to be resentful? Is this the life you want to lead? Is this the space you want to occupy? Because every moment of your life counts, whether you're resentful or not. when you die and go to judgment, they're not going to say, well, you were in a bad marriage, go back and live that over. You got to make your life count. So, another thing about resentment is that it's always an attribute of blame. And when you die and go to judgment, they're not going to ask you what your partner did.
Well, that's, we certainly believe that that's true. But let me ask you this. If you're in a situation where, with someone you care about and who presumably cares about you, and they are continually doing things that you experience as being hurtful, doesn't resentment on some levels become a way that you protect yourself?
Oh, yes. It's a defense system. The problem with it is you're more likely to be hurt when you're resentful than when you're not. I'll tell you when just about everybody goes through a period of resentment. It's when you get dumped in a relationship, or go through a divorce, or have a death in the family, and you feel that, you know, somebody else got more sympathy or something than you did. It's a perception of unfairness. You're not getting the help, appreciation, consideration, praise, reward, or affection. Now, the tragic thing about resentment is you already are hurt, but the resentment display, you know, what it look, it feels different on the inside than it looks on the outside. You look kind of mean and unfriendly when you're resentful, and that's how people respond to you. What I urge people to do is a mirror test. Think about something you resent. It's not fair. It shouldn't be that way. It's not right. Now, you'll find when you do that, you'll automatically look down away from the mirror. But you're going to be a scientist now, so hold that thought, how unfair it is and how wrong it is, and look back at the mirror, and you'll see what the world sees. You don't feel, you don't look justified. You don't look like a victim. You look mean and unfriendly.
So, in fact, in that instance, what you would want to get from other people, you're not going to get, because they're just
right.
they're just seeing the outward reacting. Gotcha.
Yeah, they're reacting to your facial expressions and your body language. The only sympathy you're going to get is from other very resentful people, but then you'll just be feeding each other's resentment.
Which is not the most healthy thing to do. So how do you tell yourself that resentment is a way to protect yourself from being hurt by whomever or whatever, is it unreasonable to want to protect yourself, or are there other ways in which to protect yourself? How do you approach that?
Yes, the best way to protect yourself is by adopting, and I call them the adult brain motivations. Improve, try to make whatever situation you're in a little bit better. Appreciate, one, there's two components of appreciation. One is that issues are very complex emotional issues. They're not simple. When we're resentful, it's all very binary. It's my way or the wrong way. So you appreciate the complexity of it, or appreciate another person. It doesn't have to be the person you resent, but the more you appreciate, see, your brain can't value and devalue at the same time. You can't raise value and lower it. So when you're raising value, you stop lowering it. So appreciate, connect, or protect. Those are ways to heal without resentment, and you'll like yourself much better.
So if you're resentful with coworker A, but you shift your focus to really appreciating coworker B, how is that helpful in terms of your relationship with coworker A?
Because you won't feel as vulnerable, and
I
if
see.
You don't feel vulnerable, you won't need the resentment or anger. In other words, you know, we teach something called compassionate assertiveness. So what people are afraid of with compassion is you're going to be a doormat. People are going to walk all over you. But that's actually not true. Resentment makes you more demanding. Compassionate assertiveness, you stand up for your rights and privileges in a way that respects the rights and privileges of other people.
So in fact, you wind up being
one of the very early I'm sorry, one of the very early studies of aggression, this is in the 1960s, found that aggressive people were not assertive. They didn't assert their rights and privileges, so they tend to swallow insult and put up with things, and then they lash out, and they get in trouble for the lashing out. And if they feel like they've been treated unfairly a long time, then they're constantly lashing out. So the more assertive you are, the less you need aggression. It's just doing it respectfully. Stand up for yourself in a way that respects the rights of others. Your rights are equal to everyone on earth, but not superior to anyone on earth.
So it sounds like it also gives you a greater sense of self-empowerment.
Absolutely. See, the swindle about resentment is that you're absolutely powerless. I feel bad, and it's your fault. There's nothing I can do about it. But when I focus on how can I make this experience a little better for myself, then I feel empowered. It's the powerlessness of resentment that makes it so bad.
You talk about the use of restorative images in order to help heal the self. What does that mean?
Well, after you've been betrayed, you're likely to have a lot of very hurtful images in your head. Some of them you might have actually perceived, but most of them you're imagining. Like if it's infidelity, you're imagining your partner with someone else. And because resentment has an obsessional quality, that means thoughts you can't get out of your mind. You're thinking about it over and over again. It's very difficult to heal that way. The restorative images would be of love and happiness. If not with that person, then with someone else. It can be spirituality, nature, something creative, a sense of community. Those are things images that can heal. If you keep going over, and revenge images are going to prevent you from healing. Anything that falls into the category of improve, appreciate, connect, or protect would be a restorative image.
So,
and that's what you want to focus on.
If my partner has been unfaithful, I think what you're saying is rather than focus on who my partner has been unfaithful with, I focus
and
on
what they were doing.
And what they were doing, then I want to focus on what brings me joy and things that I've enjoyed in my life and friends that mean something to me. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but it's not passive things that you enjoy. It's enjoyment you've created. See, when you are having a close time with a friend, say, you know, you're really connecting with her or talking to her or something, you're aware that this friend is enriching your life. What you're not aware of is that you are appreciating your friend. You are doing something active, and you're probably enriching her life. So it's what you're doing when you feel joy is what you want to focus on. You know, I should preface all of this by saying a neurological discovery in the last 15 years has been whatever you focus on actually grows in your brain. The dendrites in the brain actually grow with repeated focus. And if you focus repeatedly, it forms a habit. In other words, you'll do it automatically. So we can control how we feel by controlling what we focus on. If you focus on things that give value and meaning to your life, you'll be happier than if you focus on things that lower the value and meaning of your life.
That's a powerful piece of research that I would suggest many people, even if they've heard the words, really don't understand the actual power of being able to choose where you place your attention.
Yeah, we're able to do that because focus comes from the upper prefrontal cortex. That's the most powerful and the conscious part of the brain. Feelings come from the limbic system, which is the least powerful and more primitive part of the brain. The limbic system is fully developed on a structural level by age 3. The upper prefrontal cortex isn't fully developed till age 28. So it's much more powerful and much more mature. You know, if you ever took a course later in life, a college course or something, it was much easier for you to learn than it was when you were an undergraduate or in high school. And you thought you got smarter. You didn't really. Your IQ is the same, but your brain got so much more efficient with all those new neurons in the upper prefrontal cortex. That's where you want to solve problems, and that's where you can control your focus. Whatever you focus on is more important than what you're not focused on. So you want to choose something that will enrich your life to focus on rather than something that impoverishes it.
And is there a particular way that one can train oneself? I'm thinking about in issues of infidelity where the thoughts of what your partner is or isn't doing and with whom, they become almost intrusive. They become intrusive, and you feel as though you believe that you can't not think about them. So are there steps that one can take to push away those negative thoughts?
Yes, there are, but it's not a specific technique. In other words, I don't wait till I'm thinking of that and then try to think of something else, because that's going to be difficult. When the thought occurs to you, it already has adrenaline in it, and adrenaline is very hard to suppress. So your brain craves two classes of hormones, the adrenaline, cortisol, which are amphetamine. They give you energy and temporary confidence. And endorphins and oxytocin, which make you feel much better, calms anxiety and makes you feel closer to other people, more connected. Your brain's not going to give up one until it has the other. So if you want more endorphins and more oxytocin in your life, then you want to choose to focus on those things. And the more you focus on them, the less you'll need adrenaline. And that's how those thoughts will stop occurring to you, because your body's not craving adrenaline. See, adrenaline can actually become addictive, because the only time you either have adrenaline or you're depressed. Nobody likes to be depressed. So to militate out of depression, you start thinking about how bad it was that you were betrayed. The problem with that is that it prevents healing. So you do a general kind of healing by building more, we call a core value, more appreciation, connection, protection, and improvement into your life. And you focus on those as much as you can. Now, you're still going to have bouts where those things will come to you, but you always give them an answer. So I'm thinking, you know, he lied to me or she lied to me. But what I want is to have a close and connected relationship. So I want to think of what it's going to take for me to have a close and connected relationship. And that's going to mean being more compassionate, more appreciative, more caring. Another way to put all of this is, whenever we say, I feel anything, like I feel resentful, I feel sad, I feel angry, whatever it is, your brain loads into implicit memory a lot of other times that you felt that way. It's called state-dependent recall. You remember things that you learned or experienced when you're in the same emotional state that you're in when you learned or experienced them. So when you're resentful at your partner, you'll remember everything he did to you since 1941. But when you feel sweet and loving, you won't remember those things. You'll just remember the sweet and loving things.
Interesting. Dr. Stosny, let me interrupt you. We're going to take a break. But when we come back, I want to focus much more on your recommendation that folks who are approaching healing act on core value motivation. I'm going to ask you what that is and how you focus more on that. So folks, don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment.
Thank you.
Stosny, you say that an important part of healing from emotional abuse, deceit, infidelity, and chronic resentment is being able to act on your core values. Why is that important, and how do you even know what your core values are?
Well, that's the first step of healing. You have to decide what your core values are, but they're not that elusive, because we're hardwired with certain ones, and that's really to be caring, loving to the people you love. That's the one we come out of the womb with. The secret of healing, though, is not to focus on feelings, because feelings are always about the past. Before the break, we said that you load into implicit memory. Other times you felt whatever you're feeling now, and that tends to keep you locked in it. The other side of that is if you focus on how you want to feel. You want to feel more connected, more loving, more caring, whatever it is. Then your brain will load into implicit memory. Other times you felt that way. And you're going to select the behaviors that went with those past experiences. So you want to select behaviors that will get you where you want to go. When you were more connected, you were probably more compassionate and caring. Most people, we ask them, what kind of partner do you want to be? And that's hard for people to think about, because you're thinking about mostly what kind of partner you want to have.
Right.
But your only chance of getting the partner you most want to have is to be the partner you most want to be. So if you want to be respected, you have to be respectful. If you want to be loved, you have to be loving. If you want compassion, you got to be compassionate. Whatever you want, you've got to be. You've got to do what you want. And that's how you change. Focus on the kind of person, partner, parent you most want to be. And then your emotions will work for you. If you're focusing on how you feel when you're feeling bad, they're going to work against you. They're going to keep you stuck in those feelings, because that's all that you'll access through memory. You won't remember anything but bad experiences when you're feeling bad.
So if I'm dealing with, let's say my partner has cleaned out the 401k, I'm not feeling all that loving or caring or respectful or compassionate towards my partner. I'm feeling anything but that. So how do I mean, what's the mindset that allows me to move into the loving and caring part of perhaps who I am and who I value when I have experienced the exact reverse of that from my partner?
Well, your partner is showing that you can't trust him if he does that, so you've got to restore trust. But you can still feel compassion for his frailty, for, you know, whatever drove him to do that. That doesn't excuse it or justify it. And it's his job to rebuild trust by showing you over time that he can be trustworthy. But you have to separate compassion from trust.
I see. You talk about...
If you really understand, if he did that, that violated his own core value, and he had to go through some kind of emotional contortion to do that. Now, if you can understand that humans are frail, even if you would never do that, we all under stress can do things that we're ashamed of. And that's what compassion is. It's really for human frailty. But it's not about behavior. The behavior is wrong. The behavior has to change. It's about the person doing the behavior as a frail human like we all are. And if you see him more humanely, you feel more humane. But then you still have to decide whether you can trust him or not. You don't have to hate him to distrust him. You can trust and still distrust, still be compassionate.
And save yourself a lot of both emotional and physical energy.
Absolutely. Resentment consumes enormous amounts of energy. When you're resentful, your life has really become a joyless drive to get things done. You can function with it because it has adrenaline in it, but you don't really enjoy anything, and you're not interested in anything. That's why substance abuse goes with resentment so much. It feels so bad normally. You want to alter your consciousness with some kind of drug or alcohol.
So perhaps one of the important takeaways is that the more that you focus on hurting the person who's hurt you or the hurt that you've experienced from that person, the more you're actually hurting yourself.
Yes, the bigger that becomes in your brain, that hurt becomes sort of your identity. You begin to identify with being a victim. And you can't heal if you identify with being a victim, because then you're focused on damage, on hurt, and injustice, or, you know, whatever you're perceiving it to be. Where to heal, you got to focus on your strengths, your resilience, your mental and spiritual strengths. So it's important to focus on my healing is what's most important to me, not revenge against you.
You talked a little bit ago about compassionate assertiveness. Can you give us an example of what you mean by that, or perhaps you can share an exercise to sort of walk the listener through how that actually works?
Well, I'll tell you something I had just today with a couple of clients. This man, their husband and wife, the man said something, you know, I call them male things, like you look a little heavy in that or something to that effect. And she got really hurt and got angry at him and started, you know, you do that kind of thing on purpose. I don't think you really are making a slip to do it. Now, what she wants from him is sympathy and compassion, but she's not going to get that by attacking him. So the assertive thing to do, she's got to let him know that this hurts and that that's not acceptable, is, I know you didn't mean to hurt me when you said that, but it did hurt me. See, when you lead off that way, the other person's not going to be defensive because you're not accusing them of intentionally hurting you. If you accuse them of intentionally hurting you, they're not going to pay attention to your hurt at all. They're going to be defensive about the accusation. When you just listen to your own gut response, and urge your listeners to do this. You know, you really hurt my feelings. What's your gut response to that? Compared to, I know you didn't mean to hurt my feelings, but...
So perhaps the automatic human response is, no, I didn't.
Or what about what you did?
Okay.
Counter-accusation. But lost in that is going to be the fact that you're hurt. You'll be arguing about ego then, who did what, when, and where. And what you really need to get connected again is have the hurt attended to. Well, no, I didn't mean to, and I need to be, you know, more sensitive. That's the response you're more likely to get when you don't accuse, when you're assertive without devaluing. When you devalue, you're almost certainly going to get a devaluing response. It's called negative reactivity. There's two laws of emotional interaction. The first is positive reciprocity. That means if you're positive to someone, about 70% of the time you get a positive response. The other 30%, there's something wrong with them that has nothing to do with your interaction. They got a headache or something. Their stocks went down. You know, they lost their shoes or something. It has nothing to do with the interaction. They respond negatively. But the other law is called negative reactivity. If you approach someone with demands, with accusations, with anger or resentment, what percentage of the time you're going to get a negative response? You know, close to 100%. Now and then you'll run into Mother Teresa, but most of the time you're going to get a negative response.
So it sounds like you're saying approach the person in a way that you
want them to treat you.
Okay. And in a way that you could tolerate being approached.
Right.
Okay. So compassionate...
Yeah, be the person you want people to respond to. You don't want them to respond to your negative emotions. You want them to respond to, here's an even simpler way to put it. Focus on what you want. Resentment keeps you focused on what you don't want. I don't want deceit. I don't want betrayal. What I do want is connection, truth, caring.
Is there a way for one to begin to be able to tease out? Let's say they've ended a relationship, whether it was an intimate relationship or a work, just a relationship, work, neighbor, whatever. But now they're really concerned that they're going to go and do this again. Is there a way to begin to tease out as you enter into or contemplate entering into new relationships, whether or not this person is a good fit for you?
You know, the biggest red flag is a blamer, someone who blames all the bad things in his or her life on someone or something else. And that can be seductive early in a relationship because they will blame like a previous lover in contrast to you. Like, she was so awful. You're wonderful. But she was so, you know, she put you on a pedestal compared to the other person. And, you know, and that's seductive. We like to be on a pedestal. But the law of blame is sooner or later it's going to come to the closest person. Because that's he regulates his or she regulates her emotions by devaluing someone else. They blame, denial, and avoidance, the toddler defenses, and that's almost certainly going to come on you. So that's the biggest red flag.
And certainly, when someone puts you on a pedestal, you have to remember that that's a slippery slope on all kinds of levels.
Yes. Yeah. Even if it's not a pedestal, even positive comparison, the fact that they have to put someone down to feel okay about themselves means that that's going to come on to you in one way or another. It'll come out as deceit or abuse or infidelity if they have the chance. You know, we're getting a lot of now with the internet is sort of cyber infidelity, where they're not actually physically having sex, but they're having, you know, intimate relations over the internet. And those are just as harmful to relationships as the actual thing. In fact, sometimes they're even worse, because when you're not having the actual contact with a person, your fantasies just get way out of hand because your brain's filling in all these idealizations of what it would be like with that person. So it's not just, you know, men tend to be a little more susceptible to the internet. Men are visually stimulated, and you know, they tend to be more susceptible to it. And they also tend to be more susceptible to idealizing.
So, you know, I think it's an important point that you bring up about cyber relationships, because we know that they are so accessible, and so many times people will say, but we never had sex. I never even met this person. How can you accuse me of being unfaithful?
Yeah, well, the guide that I give to couples is if you have some contact with someone on the internet, everything you say or do with that person you have to be okay doing or saying it with your partner there. If you wouldn't do it or say it, write it with your partner there, then you shouldn't do it when they're not there. That's a good guide.
I would imagine that you've interfered with at least a number of budding cyber relationships with that guidance.
Yes, I'm proud of that.
We've been
those tend to be, even single people, those tend to be poor relationships, but they're dead disastrous for people in committed relationships.
You know, I mean, we could talk forever just about the growing existence of cyber relationships and how they, if they help, and how they, if they hurt. But for right now, let's go back to the in-person relationships that we've been talking about and that you've been addressing with Living and Loving After Betrayal. What is a first step for someone who has the sense of feeling betrayed or abandoned by a loved one or an important one in their life?
Focus more on healing the hurt rather than the fantasies of hurting the person who hurt you. You really have to choose between blame and healing because you can't do both. See, always hidden in resentment, and probably the most destructive part of it, is self-contempt. How could I have been so stupid to believe her? Or why did I trust him? You know, there's self-recrimination in it, and that's what does the most harm. And that's actually cutting into the wound in your heart. It's not only letting it heal, it's making it much worse. So you want to focus on, this was a terrible thing, I'm going to have to go through a recovery process, I will get through it. It's like having an illness, I'm going to feel bad for a while and then I will feel better. I'm going to do everything I can to defeat this illness, watch my health, boost my immune system, all of that. That's the first step. What's most important is my own health and well-being, more important than getting back at that other person.
So start with self-compassion.
Yes, exactly. In fact, what I tell couples is don't worry about compassion for the other person until you build up self-compassion. It should be an easy step from self-compassion. If you're struggling with it, build more self-compassion.
Dr. Stephen Stosny, author of Living and Loving and Betrayal, founder of Compassion Power, been working in this field for many years. I'm really pleased to have had this opportunity to speak with you. Where can listeners get more information about you, your work, your books?
Our website is CompassionPower.com, and that has a lot of free material on it, some free workbooks and other things. And things you can buy, too.
All right. Well, free is always in everybody's budget.
Yes. Well, start out with the free.
Fair enough. Thank you very much again, Dr. Stosny, for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.
Well, thanks for having me.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to myndtalk.org. You can download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store, from the Google Play Store. There are lots of places where Mind Talk is available, and it is available to you on a daily basis, not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where you are as you're listening to Mind Talk. So do send me an email with where you are and any questions or comments to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, that's MYNDTALK.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it is unacceptable. You take care.